International attention turned to the Gaza Strip in early 2009. Attaining accurate or balanced coverage on the latest war in Gaza was very difficult for many in North America, as Israel barred all major international news networks and correspondents from entering the Gaza Strip. In a significant shift, large numbers of people in North America turned to alternative sources of news to secure accurate reporting from the ground in Gaza. In the U.S., Democracy Now!, a nationally syndicated radio and television program, attracted attention for its alternative coverage on the conflict in Gaza, while internationally, heads turned towards Al Jazeera's International English Language News Service, the only major global media outlet to have extensive teams based both in Gaza and inside Israel. Recently, a major delegation of social activists and independent reporters from the U.S. crossed into the Gaza Strip to collect the details and the human story on the latest war. Democracy Now! Producer Angelique Kamat joined the delegation and has produced numerous reports and interviews from the ground in Gaza, which have been broadcast on the widely syndicated alternative news program. I had the opportunity to speak with Angelique Kamat on her recent trip to the Gaza Strip.
What struck me the most from visiting Gaza is just the absolute scale of the destruction. 3 months ago, Israel launched what it calls Operation Cast Lead, started on December 27th. It's been 3 months since this 22-day assault, and the entire Gaza Strip is still ravaged. It's unbelievable. It's a pile of rubble. All this talk of reconstruction that happened, you had this big reconstruction conference in Egypt earlier this month, several millions of dollars of aid pledged to the Gaza Strip. But, you know, as several people we spoke to, including John Gang, the head of UNRWA, said, there's not going to be any reconstruction in Gaza because there's not a single bag of cement that's being allowed in. In addition to sort of the really egregious war crimes and, you know, these new reports that Haaretz is publishing about IDF soldiers themselves saying they were under orders to attack civilian property, and, you know, a lot of different controversies coming out around that, the use of white phosphorus, the use of Palestinians as human shields, shooting at civilians carrying white flags, F-16 attacks, Apache attacks, drone attacks, using different kinds of weapons, new kinds of injuries that hadn't been seen before. On top of all of that, I think the biggest crime, in terms of what I heard from people, is the siege. And the siege has been imposed on the Gaza Strip since June of 2007, and it's still going on. And this latest attack just made it all the more worse in terms of basic life, how to continue normal daily life. I mean, forget about reconstruction. 90% of the goods getting in through to the Gaza Strip are coming in through the tunnels. The entire economy has been forced to go underground. Crossings are just not open. Crossings are open maybe a few days in a month to let in a trickle of humanitarian aid, not even anything else. I mean, before the closure was imposed, the Gaza Strip is one of these places that's been, you know, almost 100% dependent on Israel because of its policy of closure that's been imposed since 1991, since the period of so-called peace under the Oslo agreements. So, I mean, Gaza, from being completely dependent on Israel, is now completely dependent on the tunnels. It's dependent on Israel, which has closed all the crossings, Egypt, which has closed the Rafah crossing, and the only way for people to survive is to get goods in through the tunnels. The goods are very expensive, 3 to 4 times the price of what they used to be. People can't afford it. UNRWA's Chief John Ging told me that 80% of people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on food aid, entirely dependent on food aid from UNRWA. I mean, this is a situation that's not sustainable. 13,000 families that own small farms in the Gaza Strip, all of them sustain damage to their farms. It's impossible for them to have any kind of food security. I mean, Gaza, it's a beautiful place. It's on the Mediterranean. It's lush. It could be full of groves, olives, lemons, oranges, vegetables everywhere. and it's destroyed. I mean, how can this be justified under any international law? Mm-hmm. What is the justification for destroying dunums and dunums, acres and acres of farmland, for destroying chicken farms? There's no livestock in Gaza. Livestock is being imported through the tunnels. People's food security is in serious danger here. Going back to the destruction, the sort of visual impact of the destruction. I mean, tons and tons of rubble everywhere, entire neighborhoods wiped out. What was interesting to me is a lot of the neighborhoods that were completely wiped out were destroyed in the last few days of the operation as Israeli ground troops were withdrawing. In several places, the pattern was that, you know, you'd have Apaches hovering over, you'd have F-16s strikes, you'd have unmanned drone attacks, and people in the neighborhood would start to leave. In between, there would be these sort of incidents, this horrific incidents that we've heard about, shooting of civilians with white flags, children being used as human shields. But as the people would leave and they left and they would go to hospitals or wherever they could go, I mean, there was really no place safe in the Gaza Strip for those 22 days. When they would come back to their homes, those who could afford to leave, when they came back, the entire neighborhood was gone. As the Israeli tanks left the neighborhoods, they would just raise all these houses. I mean, the neighborhood in the north, Ezbat Abed Rabbo, near Jabalia, completely destroyed. I mean, 2 miles of every house, every factory, every farm, completely gone. Further down in the south, I mean, the south wasn't as badly hit as the north in this sort of recent attack. But farming village in the south, Kuzaa, destroyed. Houses everywhere hit by white phosphorus and tanks. I mean, it's just a pile of rubble. Every place is beginning to resemble what Rafah looked like and continues to look like, but started to look like when houses along the border with Egypt and Rafah were destroyed, were bulldozed, you know, in the early 2000s. It was one of these houses that Rachel Corrie, who was herself killed by a bulldozer, was trying to protect back in 2003. I mean, now the border area with Egypt is, again, just a pile of rubble. And this is where these tunnels are. You know, all this talk of a ceasefire also, I think it's important to remember that, you know, Israeli airstrikes are continuing in the south. Every day there is an attack somewhere near the tunnels, and anyone who still lives there, anyone who's still able to hold on to whatever is left of their home, is in danger. One of the first attacks that happened soon after the ceasefire was declared was for a farmer who lived in Kuzaa, who went out to look at his farms after the so-called ceasefire was called, and he was killed. And I think something else that people were really talking to me about is that they've invested their life savings. They've invested so much in building these homes, in tending these farms. Farmers we spoke to, you know, so many of them said, we grow these plants like our children so we can live off of them, so we can, you know, grow this fruit, grow this vegetable, sell it in the market, you know, feed our families so we can have some kind of security, and to destroy all of this, all of these plants, all of these farms. And what they want is some guarantee from their government, from the international community, that this will not happen again. And they don't know. Who can give them that guarantee? And I think that for me was, you know, really heartbreaking, because you have, you know, in spite of everything, you know, what's called in Arabic sumud, the sort of steadfastness of Palestinians, I mean, in complete force, people come back to this basically a pile of rubble every day. Whoever's left from the family comes and sits there just to make sure that nobody can claim this plot of land that's his or her land. Because that's their land, and they have the deed to it, and they live there. 3/4 of the Gaza Strip are refugees, but a lot of the destruction also happened not in refugee camps, but in areas where people had owned the land for centuries. I mean, the refugee camps faced enormous destruction as well. What was interesting to me also is to meet people who aren't refugees, who have now become, sort of formed this new generation of refugees, and then talking also to some older people who were around during 1948, who were refugees, and who said they've never been more scared than they were during this recent operation. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that really should give us all pause.
You mentioned the aid conference that happened in Cairo. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Cairo for this conference. I'm wondering what your sense was from people on the ground in Gaza as to the new U.S. administration. Was there cynicism? What was the impression of the U.S. administration, the current U.S. administration?
I think most people feel that there is not going to be much change, even under Obama administration. I think people were impressed by the individual that Barack Obama is, and that the fact that he was elected. I think a lot of people were genuinely surprised, as people were the world over, that America elected its first African-American president. But at the same time, in terms of expecting any real policy change towards Israel and Palestine, I think people were quite cynical. I mean, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, promised $900 million in aid to reconstruct Gaza. And I mean, none of this aid is actually going to get to Gaza. Two-thirds of it is going to the Palestinian Authority, to Fatah in Ramallah, to beef up its security forces, and the rest of it is supposed to get to Gaza. But the international community and the United States does not recognize Hamas as a legitimate government, so it's unclear who the money is going to actually go to and how it's actually going to get to Gaza.
Could you maybe talk about what's happening along the border in Rafah and the importance of the tunnels? There are bombings that are targeting these tunnels between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. But talk about how important they are to the economy and generally the perception of these tunnels within the society in Gaza.
Well, the tunnels are a lifeline for the Gaza Strip. They are the only exit and entry point into the Gaza Strip. You have every single thing imaginable coming through the tunnels, anything that's required to sustain a population, including basics, milk, meat, lamb, chicken, clothes, shoes, blankets, diapers, sanitary items, toiletries. Everything comes in through the tunnels. What's interesting to me is that the tunnels are completely visible. When you get to Rafah, you see them. They're like these big sort of greenhouse type of structures, tarpaulin-covered structures all along the border. And everybody knows that they exist. I think most people are of two minds about the tunnels. On the one hand, they realize this is the only thing that's, you know, allowing them to survive. On the other hand, the tunnels have also created a different kind of economy. They've created a whole new group of people who are becoming rich off of the tunnels, people who cannot continue to use sort of more traditional means of running their businesses, have started digging tunnels, invest money in digging tunnels, put their former workers, their former employees to work in digging the tunnel, and getting these goods and selling them at very high prices. One economist I spoke to was quite opposed to the tunnel and felt that it, in addition to sort of enriching some people at the expense of others and allowing this black market economy to proliferate in Gaza, he also talked about how, you know, the Palestinians don't want to be seen as a nation of tunnel diggers. There are people looking for peace, looking to live normal lives, looking for justice. And, you know, it's a shame that people have been forced to turn underground for survival. At the same time, I mean, there is really no other choice. They've been driven to this situation. Like I said, 80% of the refugee population in Gaza is dependent on UNRWA for food. But everybody else is dependent on the tunnels. Israel will keep bombing these tunnels. But even while we were there, we saw a few tunnels that had been bombed the night before. And people from the neighborhood were there at 6 in the morning starting to rebuild it. The unemployment rate in the Gaza Strip is 70%. There's no work. There's no way to make an income. And the only route for sort of young men is to go start working on digging tunnels. I met so many people, former farmers, drivers, college students, with no job prospects, so they turned to digging tunnels.
There was a lot of discussion internationally around Israel's decision to ban the international press from entering Gaza during the latest war. And Al Jazeera and also Democracy Now!, where you work, were widely followed as alternative media sources. Al Jazeera specifically was, you know, the only international news agency with reporters on the ground in Gaza. So what is your take, having visited Gaza, as to the quality and the ways in which the last war was covered by the international press?
One of the things that's came to the fore from being in Gaza is the timing of the operation. Israel planned this operation and launched it between Christmas and New Year, when most internationals in the Gaza Strip, internationals working in the Gaza Strip, are not in there. And then they ban the foreign press. So it gives Israel a free hand to do whatever it wants to do, which is precisely what happened. And like you said, Al Jazeera was the only international media inside the Gaza Strip. There were a few other reporters, Spanish and others, who kind of came in through the Free Gaza boats, who reported from inside the Strip while under war for a few days. One of the things that's important to note is that you had all the international media standing on the border with Israel. That's where they were reporting from. And it's no surprise that much of the media was tainted by this effort to try and show balance. Every single media report, international media report, would talk about Sderot and Gaza at the same time. It was impossible to talk about what was happening in Gaza, to talk about the pain and the trauma of what was going on to the 1.5 million inhabitants of Gaza squeezed into this tiny strip, without making some kind of equivalence between that and what was going on in Sderot. Israelis being sort of under, you imagine, this rain of rockets coming down. But it was completely not comparable. At the end of the day, you had 13 or 14 Israelis who were killed versus 1,400 Palestinians. Under international law, this gets talked about in terms of proportionality, but also it became impossible to talk about Gaza unless you had this impression of balance. You had to also talk about Hamas violations. You had to also talk about rockets hitting Israelis, the trauma of Israeli children living under fear of getting hit by a rocket. The other thing that I think the international media misses is the complexities within Gaza. So on the one hand, feeling the need, feeling compelled to make this equivalence between Gaza and Israel. And on the other hand, there are a variety of sort of complex things going on the ground in Gaza. There is inside Gaza a lot of diversity of opinion about Hamas, for example. People are sort of, from this operation, people were very concerned, a lot of people we spoke to, about what was the point of this resistance and what was the resistance. The end of the 22-day operation, Hamas officials basically declared this a victory. And a lot of people in Gaza were furious. And these are people who, you know, voted for Hamas in 2006 because they wanted a change from the sort of long years of corruption under Fatah. And these are people who are extremely critical of Fatah. And I was surprised by how much people were sort of angry with the sort of cynical attitude that Hamas has taken towards its population. This is something that's difficult to talk about in the West because it immediately gets used as fodder for the Israeli lobby, which is not what it should be at all. It's just about sort of complexities of life inside Gaza and where people are living, you know, under the gun, under Israeli guns. People are living, you know, in a pile of rubble trying to reconstruct their lives. You know, so a lot of people were also very critical of this, and also unsure of how to speak about it. And this kind of discussion, you know, rarely makes it to the international media in an intelligent way. It is difficult to talk about because clearly the aggressor is Israel. But on the other hand, people within Gaza want a variety of things also. And, you know, the ways in which sort of the responsibilities of journalists to sort of get all of that together and bring that story out, I think, is important, and I don't think that's really happened. And the third thing is that, you know, the devastation of Gaza did not begin and end with Operation Cast Lead. You have to talk about the siege, and I think you have to go back further as well and talk about Israel's policy of closure. You know, before 1991, Gaza and the West Bank weren't as separate as they are now. People from Gaza could travel throughout Israel and the West Bank. They had jobs in Israel. And through the period of Oslo, less, fewer and fewer Gazans could find employment in Israel because of Israel's policy of closure. And the same thing with the West Bank. I think this is a big factor in sort of what we have today, which is 70% unemployment in the Strip.
You have been listening to an interview with Angelique Kamat, producer at Democracy Now, who spoke on a recent trip to the Gaza Strip. which took place after the most recent war in Gaza, a conflict that attracted international attention as large parts of the Gaza Strip were destroyed, universities bombed, and over 1,300 Palestinians left dead. In North America, for the first time, significant numbers of people turned to alternative sources of news to secure accurate reporting from the ground in Gaza during this latest war. In the U.S., Democracy Now!, the nationally syndicated television and radio program, attracted attention for its alternative coverage on the conflict. For more information on Democracy Now!, visit www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. This interview has been produced for broadcast on CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stéphane Christophe.